We're going to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I think we have so many individuals that have agreed to testify on housing and employment. It's important for us to get going. Before we do that, I did not acknowledge the fact that we have a new Republican staffer, and so if you could introduce yourself for the committee, that'd be great.
My name is Jason Foster, and I'm doing research for the Republican Caucus.
And we have a permanent page, and you are? Thank you.
And
thank you. Okay, we're going to get, did you get the information that you needed?
Two seconds.
But for those of you that are wearing red and didn't realize that today's Wear Red for Women to acknowledge heart disease as one of the huge pillars among women. So thank you for wearing your red and not even knowing it. We have a quorum. Let's see. Representative Wardlow, would you mind moving the minutes for us?
So moved.
Are there any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say yes.
Aye.
Any nays? Okay. Are you ready? Kinda? Okay. You can identify yourself for the tape. We'd appreciate it.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Peck. I'm with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and my position there is the Director of Rehabilitation Services. Rehabilitation Services is commonly referred to RS, so I will be using that acronym. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to provide the committee with a very brief summary of the services that DEED provides to individuals with serious mental illness. I'm mindful of the committee's time, so the information that I will provide will be a very high overview of the services that we provide. The service delivery system is very complex, and DEED is just one part of that system, and I will be talking specifically of those services that are provided through Rehabilitation Services, that branch of DEED. As you see on this slide, the values that you see there, meaningful work, self-determination, informed choice, inclusion, and freedom from discrimination, are the values that direct our work at Rehabilitation Services. As the program director, I expect all rehab services staff to embrace these values in their daily services to the clients that we serve in order to meet our mission of empowering Minnesotans with disabilities to achieve their goals for employment, independent living, and community integration. Individuals with serious mental illness want to be healthy and independent. They want housing, they want transportation, they want jobs. And productive and meaningful employment is not just a goal, it's a necessity. Last week, I understand that this committee heard compelling testimony on the challenges of finding and keeping employment. Rehab Services knows that challenge, and so do I, based on my long-term experience in working with persons with serious mental illness. From our perspective, Rehabilitation Services, employment is key to the quality of an individual's life. It's not, particularly for persons with serious mental illness, it's not the reward for getting well. In fact, it is a vital part of their recovery. So our business at Rehab Services is to assist our clients in getting and keeping their jobs. And I, as the Director of Rehabilitation Services, will be the very first to admit that we are not perfect in doing our work, and the resources that we have fall significantly short of our ability to meet everyone's needs. There are three programs within the Department of Employment and Economic Development in the Rehab Services branch that receive some or all funding from the state that serve individuals with serious mental illness. As I said, initially these programs work in collaboration with agencies, counties, businesses, communities across Minnesota. There is no way that DEED and Rehabilitation Services can accomplish our mission without close collaboration with these important stakeholders or partners. At the simplest level, these programs, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program and the Extended Employment Programs, provide one or both of two functions. First, they assist a person with a serious mental illness to get a job. And secondly, they assist that individual in keeping that job and flourishing in their work for as long as they need that support. The vocational rehabilitation program, its mandated purpose is to... Their mandated purpose is to work with clients to be hired in the job they want and to stabilize them in their employment. The counselors, the VR counselors, have broad discretion in using their skills and case service dollars to help their clients succeed. Because VR is a state-federal partnership with over three-quarters of the funds coming from Washington, we are obligated to work under federal mandates. The most significant of those mandates, as it impacts individuals with serious mental illness, is that the services must be time-limited. Once an individual is stable in their position, VR or rehabilitation services support must fade out. VR services for individuals with serious mental illness and, frankly, for all persons with disability have been even and, frankly, sometimes ineffective. Budget constraints that the Rehabilitation Services Vocational Rehab Program have experienced in the past several years led to, at one point, having a waiting list of services with over 6,000 people on that waiting list. No access to employment services for individuals on that waiting list was, at the very least, significantly problematic for those individuals, and frankly, it was very demoralizing for staff as well. The federal mandates, in addition to the time-limited services, another critical federal mandate that constrains our ability is the mandate that says in order for a VR counselor to write an employment plan for an individual who is going to require ongoing supports to be successful in their employment, that counselor must be able to identify on the front end stable, available, ongoing support. We have had situations where the VR counselor and their client have sat down, have talked about employment goals and objectives, have readily recognized the need for ongoing support, and those supports do not exist. In those situations, both the counselor and, more importantly, the customer are at a standstill. In the last year, VR, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, has served over 6,000 persons with mental illness. That is approximately about one-third of the persons we served last year. We had, of those persons with serious mental illness, approximately one-third or 700 persons were successfully employed, met the federal definition and our definition of successful rehabilitation. These numbers are nowhere where I would like to see them be. But we have made some improvements. Back in 1980, and I actually started out in the mental health service delivery arena in 1977, so I remember these days well. Back in 1980 in the vocational rehabilitation program, I was one of those social workers in adult protection who was referring people into the vocational rehabilitation program. Only 16% of the people served by VR were persons with serious mental illness. It was at that point in time where the mindset was individuals with serious mental illness can't work. Also at that point in time, vocational rehabilitation was not operating under an order of selection. And that impacted, again, the degree to which we were providing services with to individuals with the most significant disability. In 2001, let me just say that now in terms of Minnesota, we are serving 32% of persons, 32% of the people that we are serving are individuals with serious mental illness. In 2001, nationally, the vocational rehabilitation program was serving 22%. 22% of the people that they were serving were individuals with serious mental illness. In Minnesota, I'm pleased to say that that our percentage is higher than the national average, that being 33%. There is still much work to be done. The services that we can provide, as I said before, nowhere even begin to meet the need. And what we are striving to do in the vocational rehabilitation program is to expand and develop innovative programs that are based on evidence-based practice to more effectively serve people with serious mental illness. Some of the projects briefly that I will touch on, we are working collaboratively with the Department of Human Services using grant funds from the Johnson & Johnson Institute to increase the adherence to evidence-based practice in four of our coordinated employability projects. There are 26 of those projects across Minnesota that are provided in partnership with DHS, and the important variable or important characteristic of those projects is that they are working closely with DHS, and it's very clearly that in evidence-based practice for persons with serious mental illness, the mental health services need to be provided in collaboration with the employment services. Another project that you see noted there, Rehabilitation Services is funding a project with RISE. RISE's executive director, John Barrett, is here today. That project is linking the Consumer Wellness Recovery Project with employment. Also, something that I'm pleased to describe is, again, based on my experience and my frustration with the lack of supported employment resources for persons with serious mental illness, when Ramsey County was able to provide some assertive community treatment programs, I made a commitment to provide 2 VR staff to work directly with those ACT teams, not only to work directly with the individuals being served by those ACT teams, but more importantly to build the capacity of the other staff on those ACT teams so they understood the expertise needed to effectively serve individuals with mental illness and employment-related issues. The challenge, frankly, with employment for persons with serious mental illness is significantly impacted by a recurrence of their symptoms. That can come about just as a mere fact or reality of the disorder, the disability. Also, it can come as a result of life stressors. And because of that, the importance, because of that, ongoing supports are critically important. And that brings us to talking about the services provided by the Extended Employment Program, that part of DEED. I'm very proud to say that that program is 100% state-funded. I commented very directly to David Esquith, who is the head of the Monitoring Division of the Federal Rehab Services Administration, and I said to him, we are very fortunate to have the Extended Employment Program, because were it not for those state funds, what would we be doing for individuals with serious mental illness? The reason that those ongoing supports are so critical is that those supports provide the opportunity to intervene and provide assistance to individuals before their job performance is seriously affected, before their ability to maintain or keep their job is impacted. And these ongoing supports provided through the EE program, extended employment is referred to as EE often, those supports are long-term. They may last for years or perhaps even a person's entire working career. The Rehabilitation Services Program of DEED operates 2 programs in the Extended Employment Services project. Those programs provide funding to community rehabilitation providers to provide those ongoing supports. There's the EE Basic Program, which is open to persons with serious disabilities regardless of the specific diagnosis. And then we have the EE SMI, the Extended Employment Program for Persons with Serious Mental Illness. The goals of both of those programs are to provide, again, that ongoing support for individuals so they can be successful in their job. But there are some important distinctions between the EE Basic and the EE SMI program that merit noting. The Extended Employment Program for Persons with Serious Mental Illness started in the early 1990s with a collaboration with DHS, and I talked about that before. By design, the services, the ongoing supports in that program provide ongoing support as well as rapid engagement to place people in jobs. The jobs that individuals in the EESMI program have are jobs in the community. They are in integrated settings, and these jobs pay competitive wages. The EESMI projects are paid on reported hours of service provided, and the challenge and the sobering reality with the EESMI is that statewide coverage of these services is a major problem. Only 12 counties currently have EESMI projects. Mm-hmm. Pardon me? Okay. And a number of the projects within these counties have waiting lists.
Reverse, we are missing in 12 counties, mostly rural.
Oh, okay.
We're also, frankly, undercovered in our metro counties.
Okay. Thank you, John. The EE Basic program is Rehabilitation Services' other major provider of ongoing supports to persons with serious mental illness. contrasting to the EESMI program, the majority of the EE basic supports are provided in community settings without integration or in center-based workshops. The wages do, however, range from competitive to sub-minimum wage. Currently, the EE basic provides supports to more workers with serious mental illness than in the EESMI project. It has wider coverage, but unfortunately, again, it does not pay for placement. So these, the VR program, the EESMI program, the extended employment program, basic, are the three programs under rehabilitation services that provide employment-related services to individuals with serious mental illness. At this point, I'm happy to answer any questions that the chair or the members of the committee might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pastor, Mr. Sherman, could you tell me what I'm looking at? You kindly sent us a report yesterday, and on page 4 of that report, it says number of persons with SMI served by county, and then it has it broken down by employment for people with serious mental illness or the basic. What does served mean? Does that mean they got a job or they met with a counselor but did not get a job all lumped together?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, for the record, I'm John Sherman with the Community Partners Program of DEED. The answer is, in a classic fashion, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, both. For the extended employment basic program, by definition, the individuals are working because we pay on an outcome-based system on hours of work. And you can certainly question the directors of the program, who will be behind you. For the EESMI program, because in fact this was intentionally designed into the system, it includes both placement services and employment, so that an individual can come into one of the projects and say, essentially, I want a job, and then be about the business of finding a job, and then if the job, and working to find the job, and then providing the supports. It's designed to be seamless between the two systems. So if you were looking at EE Basic, you were looking at someone who's already working. If you were looking at someone in EESMI, it may be somebody who is looking for a job or is already working. Typically, it's about 60% of the individuals in EESMI at any given time are working, and about 30% are in the status of looking for employment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherman or Ms. Peck, what does working mean? Could it be 1 hour a week? Does it have to be 20?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I have some program outcomes here from Federal Fiscal Year 06 that I can provide to you. In the EESMI program, the average hour numbers of work per week looks like in 2004 were 13 hours a week, 2006 were 11 hours per week. In the EE Basic program, the average number of hours worked, 15 hours per week.
Add a little bit to that. May I add a little comment to...
Go ahead, Mr. Sherman.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, the range is, it could be one, work is paid employment, and we mean paid employment at a location. The number of hours worked varies by the individual, so it could be 1 hour, it could be 40. And that is both a factor of the individual's ability to work and of course, the ability of employers to have hours for people to be working in. The other sets of numbers. Actually, and these are VR employment outcomes, these are not extended employment outcomes, roughly in our placements in 06, working 40 hours or more, the average hours of work for all individuals were 32. The average in employment without supports, that is in competitive employment. For individuals who are self-employed, it dropped to 27, and for individuals who are employment with supports, which is the area that we're typically talking about here,
It's typically at placement 24 to 25 hours a week. Again, that is an average number, so individual experience can vary pretty greatly. It is part of the VR goal to work with individuals who are trying to achieve their maximum level of employment. And again, the condition can be significant.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Riley.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just one final comment. I'm very pleased that you had the hearing that included employment, and I know we've got a lot of testifiers, so I'm not going to talk much longer. But when we get around to House File 196, there is a section on employment, so I hope members will remember what we have today as we, you know, I'm hoping to introduce the topic of having not only more employment, which does a lot of good for people's recovery, but also some more accountability than we currently have, I believe, in making sure that the money we spend actually comes out with jobs and substantial jobs.
Good point. Any other questions? Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got it. I was looking at the numbers of the counties, and you talked about there are about 12 of them that, and I looked at mine, and it was 000, and I think I went to 3 funerals of someone who had committed suicide this fall. How do we go about getting some of these programs in some of these areas where we have a high level of mental health issues?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative, I think the simplest answer to that, and I wish I wish accomplishing that was simple, but the simplest answer is, I think, to significantly increase the level of awareness and to be sure that adequate funds are available to meet those needs. I was chatting with a gentleman before the hearing began, and we still have much work to do to dispel the myth related to individuals with serious mental illness and their ability to work. The Surgeon General's report that came out in 1999 was a big step forward in terms of saying employment can be a significant piece. But I think if we can dispel the myth about individuals with serious mental illness, if we can help the community at large better understand that employment is key to individuals' recovery, and we can provide the resources that those individuals need to be successful in employment and to provide the supports to the employer to better understand and to better make room, if you will, in their employment setting for the diversity of the individuals that we serve, then I think we can make some headway. But none of that will happen without resources and without better education.
Thank you. Actually, I'm going to follow up on Representative Otremba's question, because resources, of course, is needed, but I'm interested in knowing how the 12 counties was picked. Was there a process in determining that? And if so, what would it be, if we had the resources, what would be the determination on how to move to the new counties?
Again, for the extended employment SMI, which is it's 12 counties that are not. The 26 projects statewide, the employability projects, are historical, and they've been based on competitive RFPs over a period of a decade, essentially. And essentially what happened is that we established those programs with federal vocational rehabilitation dollars. And because those programs were time limited, at a certain point, they essentially came to a cliff, and the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, has provided funding to keep them going. But every one of them has been a competitive process selected jointly by staff from Human Services and Rehab Services and recommended to management in both programs. It has been in the program a conscious effort to build a statewide structure, but as Ms. Peck just said, we've run out of funds in that area. About 4 years ago, during the budget cutbacks, these programs were cut back. We've had to keep funding new programs coming in, so we've been stretching the dollars, and the dollars have only stretched so far.
Yeah. That's helpful. Any other questions or comments by members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
If we can get Mr. Trepp and Mr. Searle to come down at the same time, that'd be helpful. Welcome to our committee, and if you could say your names for the tape so we could have that on record, appreciate that.
My name is Harry Searles.
Hi, I'm John Trepp, and this is Harry Searles. We're both from Tasks Limited, and we're glad to be here today, and Harry's going to go first.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Work and play. Work and play. Tasks Unlimited furnishes close on-the-job supervision of its mentally ill client janitors. This enables task clients to do a good job. There's always the coordinator, boss, on site to keep the clients working. This is supported employment from degreed mental health professionals. Occasionally, a task client graduates to competitive employment, whether with tasks or separate from the agency, as in my case. I am a competitive church custodian and earn $11.68 an hour. When I left tasks over 8 years ago, I had been earning $6.28 an hour. Now I hold the first-class operating engineer's license. The clients get the supervision necessary, and they contribute much good work. The clients also get their paychecks. And this is the magic of Lodge Magic, along with the close friendships that obtain among the clients. When this sort of thing happens, the terrible mentality of the RTC Regional Treatment Center is dispelled. No, you can't. You may not. I have the keys. I won't let you. You're a lifer. You'll be back. You'll be back. Perhaps Tasks Unlimited shines most brightly in the money it saves society by keeping its clients off the psych wards and out of the regional treatment centers. This June 9 through 11, my wife and I will join a few other task clients to see the sites in Duluth for $250. Thanks to tasks, we have the $250. It's all about money. Client labor makes tasks economically viable. Tasks makes us socially, psychologically, and vocationally viable, and therefore financially viable in the greater community. You may have heard of the term consumer. Well, my family produces more than it consumes, and we don't merely subsist in abject poverty through government largesse. In two words, tasks works. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Searles. Mr. Trepp.
Hi. I've chosen as a handout the Task Limited 2005 annual report. I want to talk about EE generally and not just about Tasks Limited, but I think I can use some of the data that's in this report to do that. On the bottom of page 2, where unfortunately my picture is, I talk about the fact that I've been in this field for 30 years, and I've never met anyone who didn't want to work. I routinely meet people who are discouraged, who are scared of working, who are underskilled, and who especially I meet a lot of people who are worried about losing their benefits. But fortunately, those are problems we know how to solve. I really don't run into people that don't want to be a productive member of society, and I think that's important to remember. In the upper right-hand corner of page 3, there are a couple of charts there. In the interest of time, I'm going to simplify this data. Basically, this is a story of about 200 people with mental illness who joined the TASC Extended Employment Basic Program during the 1990s. The top graph shows their hospitalization data, and the lower graph shows their employment status. Now, we only track people for 5 years because our ability to find them starts to slide. We get about 90% response on the first, on the 1 year anniversary, and about 80% on the 5th year anniversary, and after that it falls off. But from anecdotal evidence, from those people who entered in back in 1990, and we still know where they are, suggest to me that these lines stay straight, probably for as much as 15 years and maybe beyond that. About 80% of these folks are still employed, and they spend less than a week each year in the hospital. Now, there's another important thing about these graphs, and perhaps you can notice that the upper graph is sort of the mirror image of the lower graph. And that's not a coincidence. Employed people are very unlikely to seek inpatient psychiatric treatment. Sometimes people think I'm joking about this, but I'm not. Every week I talk to consumers at Tasks Unlimited, workers at Tasks Unlimited, and sometimes they describe some very serious symptoms that they're having. And sometimes I'll ask them, do you think you should go to the hospital? And generally they say, I can't go to the hospital. I have a job. I got to get to work. I have to be to work at such and such a time. And I can't be messing around with going to the hospital. I should explain a little bit about the photo on page 4. Photo on page 4 shows a couple of our folks, Joe and Fernando, in front of the Eiffel Tower. Some people who have seen this photo have asked me, well, why should the taxpayers be spending money to send people to Paris? The answer is you didn't. The taxpayers, through the Extended Employment Basic Program, gave Tasks Limited money to find these guys jobs, to keep them healthy mentally, and to keep them showing up for work every day. Joe and Fernando worked hard, they paid their taxes, they paid their bills, and they had money left over to take a vacation. Harry and his wife are going to go to Duluth. These guys went to Paris. This is the type of outcome we ought to expect from extended employment. On page 5, there is a description of where the task's revenue comes from by type. Now, this chart does not identify the source, but basically, TASC gets about $500,000 each year from the state, mostly through the EE Basic Program. This is a very good investment for the state of Minnesota, and not just at TASC, but throughout the state. The $11 or $12 million that the state puts into EE Basic produces good employment outcomes for about 7,000 people, and mostly these are people with mental illness. Now, I promised I wouldn't get up here and bash other employment initiatives. I guess they're all good in their own way. But let me assure you, and I feel like an expert on this, the most efficient way to obtain additional employment for people with mental illness is to add funding to EE Basic. EE Basic puts people to work. One other program I should flag that's a really good program that you may or may not be familiar with is called Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disability, in shorthand, MAEPD. This was an initiative passed by the state of Minnesota in 1999 with very little fanfare. A lot of people have never heard of it. But what it does is it allows folks like Harry and Joe and Fernando to work hard, to earn a living, to get off of disability, and yet still to access medical assistance by paying a premium. Most of our folks pay between $75 and $125, I think, a month to access medical assistance, and that allows them to maintain their mental health, and that's really a terrific idea. Minnesota is one of the leaders in that area. It's a great program and one that really pays for itself. With that, Harry and I can take questions if there are any.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions that members may have? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Searles or Mr. Trepp, the EE Basic, you said you use mostly. So did you ever use EESPMI, and why do you mostly use EE Basic?
Well, EE Basic is a relatively small program. Excuse me, EESPMI is a relatively small program. I think we used to get about $65,000 a year out of that. It's fairly small compared to EE Basic. Quite frankly, we found EE Basic works better for us, and there may be other programs that EESPMI works better. But for Task Limited, our folks are all working, and when you're actually working, EE Basic works better for us.
That's it, Representative Growling. Anyone else? Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. If we can get Mr. Coffey and Mr. Barrett to come up together. Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. My name is John Barrett with Rise Incorporated.
My name is King Coffey. I'm a client of Rise.
Thank you for coming.
Okay. I came to Minnesota in about 84, and I was with Honeywell, and then in 1990, I discovered that I had a serious mental illness, so they took me to the hospital for a few years. Then I got out, I tried looking for work, but I couldn't find because of a lapse in my employment and because of my hospitalization. So I went to Rise, I turned to Rise in about 2001, and they found employment for me, and I was able to work ever since and stay at the mental institution. So I've been employed kind of on a continuous basis. I was working part-time, I was in the hospital, but they gave me a part-time job that I can do within the community and not be a burden and, getting welfare or things of that nature. So they helped me to make my own money, and plus I'm not at home. I think to myself where people can't see me, I might become psychotic or so. So this way, people can see me that I am doing fine, and it gives me a incentive to give back to the community and to work every other day or as I can. I also do volunteer work for my church.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Any questions that anyone may have or comments? Ms. Barrett, go ahead.
Thank you. RISE is a community rehabilitation program, and we serve the metro area, primarily Hennepin and Anoka counties, but also work in the Chisago Lakes area and have a small office in St. Cloud. RISE started in 1971, and it started by a group of parents in the Anoka Spring Lake Park area who were looking at options for their sons and daughters as they graduated out of special ed programs, and they wanted them to be able to work and be able to work locally, and there was no services available. So that's how RISE got its start, and we primarily worked with a variety of people with disabilities. In the mid-1980s, we were starting to get more in requests from people with mental health disabilities to get into a job situation. And at that time, we had a small grant that we were able to receive from Rehab Services, because we knew if we were going to do that, we had to hire people with expertise in mental health and with mental illness. The only program in Minnesota at that time that was doing vocational services with this population was Tasks Unlimited. So we had the distinction of being number two. Last year, RISE served 393 people in supported employment. And we do that in a couple of different ways. We had about 90 people that are in group or enclave situations where RISE contracts with various companies, and we're typically the payrolling agent, so we are able to run work crews there of between 8 and 10 people in some of those situations. There we have a staff person that's there on a regular basis, and others they may be there part of the time. That gives us the flexibility because we are the payrolling agent that if somebody starts with us, we're able to move them into a job situation quickly. If a person is only able to work a few hours a day or a few hours a week, we're able to deal with that situation because from the company standpoint, they want a certain amount of work done. We're contracting with them to do that. So we have a lot of control over people moving in and out. People aren't going to lose their job if they happen to not be able to work for a couple of weeks, a variety of situations like that. And those jobs are located in various places. We have Precision Manufacturing downtown Minneapolis. King works for Minco Companies and a variety of companies like that throughout the Twin City area. Last year, we also worked with 307 people that were in individual job-supported job placements. And basically that just means that rather than have a group situation, we've got an individual in a job, maybe the only person we have in a job at that company. There may be some larger companies like Minco where we'll have people in different departments doing different tasks. The staff support varies depending on need and varies depending on the wants of the company as well. Again, that gives us a fair amount of flexibility, and we're able to move people through that system on occasion. The majority of jobs right now with supported employment individual placements, we are the payrolling agent. There's also situations where the company is paying the person directly. And last year we also had 56 people that we put into competitive employment in our definition. And what that means is that those 56 people were in employment situations where they were fairly stable. We were still providing some support. But between the employer and the employee, we had arranged so that basically everything that was going on that might be of question, they were dealing with directly. We were able to fade out of that situation where we had to be the intermediary with anything that's going on. In all of those supported employment situations, we also try to hook people up with peer support. That may be family and friends, or it may be the Consumer Survivor Network, where we can get people associated with them so that there's not only our staff doing supports, but also supports coming from other situations. With those 56 people, our goal is that we can start to fade out of the picture. And for us, that's sort of the ultimate success, where somebody's working, they're doing well, they're in the community, and we don't have to provide ongoing services on a regular basis any longer. We let people know that if they ever need any support, simply to call us and we'll be there, both the employer and the employee. And that happens frequently during the first year or so. 3 months ago, we had a call from an employer that we had placed someone at 13 years ago who needed some help at this point. And, of course, we went back in and started working with that individual again. But that system seems to work extremely well. Funding for services that we do, the supported employment and competitive employment, really is sort of a mix. We get dollars. There's case service dollars from rehab services for some people that might be available. Some of the counties put dollars in for services. Hennepin County and Anoka County both put dollars in for services. As was mentioned, the extended employment program, the extended employment basic, puts dollars in for services. The EESPMI, extended employment, those grants that were being talked about, they also are very important. Now, those for us are extremely important because we negotiate with the DRS staff in looking at a project, and we're able to come up with a cost for the service hour. And EE Basic, we get reimbursed by cost of the hour worked by a participant. And these grants, we get paid for the service hour. So we're able to, in some cases, pay for front-end services, placement, some of those kinds of things that we don't have access to other dollars for. So for us, that's a very valuable funding source. Now, I think everybody knows probably that the unemployment rate in the Twin Cities is about 4.4% now. The unemployment rate, if you look at folks with disabilities, you hear numbers anywhere from, 50% up to, for people with severe and persistent mental illness, 85%. So there are ways, and there are companies out there willing to hire people if they have support, if they're trained, if they can do different jobs. And we have that workforce available to go out there. And if there were more resources available for any of these, it's not a question of not having the ability to do it or not having the opportunity to do it. It really is the question of having the resources in the right place at the beginning to be able to do that. With that, I will open it up for any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Representative Grylin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barrett, do you have any charts similar to the ones that PATH Unlimited had showing the mirror image of people once they're employed, they stay out of the hospital? And then my second question is, do you only deal with people with SPMI?
We do have those kinds of charts, and we can get those for you. They basically mirror what John was talking about. If somebody, it used to be that it was often told to people that you shouldn't work, you're not ready to work, those kinds of things. what we found intuitively over the years and what some of the research more recently with evidence-based practices has shown is that if somebody is working, they're less likely to be hospitalized, they're less likely to be in a crisis. And it just fits in, and it makes a lot of common sense that that be true. And King certainly could attest to that, I mean, as he has here already. I'm old and forget very quickly, so what was the second part of the question?
Okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. I can relate to that. The second question was, do you deal with people only with people with SPMI or others that have a mental illness but aren't SPMI?
We deal with that whole gamut. When somebody comes to us, initially we don't necessarily look to see what their label is. We look at whether we can provide a job for them. We also know that the quicker we can get somebody into a job, the more effective we're going to be. And again, that's one of the things we try to do. And that's all connected to resources and having the ability to do that.
What percentage are SPMI then of your clients?
I would have to get that information for you. I would hate to say, I think it's at least 50%. It might be higher than that.
If you can get that to our committee administrator, good old Jen, to make sure that the members of the committee get that. Anything else, Representative Garland? Or anything from other members of the committee? Well, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. This is going to wrap up our employment, wanting to make sure that individuals have a couple ideas of different options that are out there for individuals that have mental illness as a diagnosis. And so if there's things that we're missing, please let us know so we can get that information to you. If Ms. Larson could come up from the department, please. And we asked Ms. Larson to talk from the Department of Corrections point of view, one, because in Representative Greiling's, there is some public safety and corrections language in there, but also the amount of individuals, unfortunately, that are in our correction systems that have severe and moderate and mild mental health issues. Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And as part of my responsibility, I'm responsible for the behavioral health services. And we have some really very special staff in our behavioral health services team who deal primarily with release planning for our SPMI population. We have been targeting resources to release planning for our SPMI population probably since the mid-90s, but the legislature in 2003 appropriated some funding for us very specifically for release planning for the SPMI offender. We currently have 3.25 FTEs of release planners, but even though that seems small, they're really part of a team that works not only with our staff inside the institutions, but also with our community partners. So, and they're also really very tenacious, so they're great staff. In fiscal year 2006, our release planners actually touched about 1,700 offenders in their release planning efforts. Services are voluntary. The offender does not have to participate in release planning, but as I said, our release planners are very tenacious, and they will just dog those mentally ill offenders to ensure that they have a comprehensive plan. A comprehensive plan takes about 20 hours, and I'm just giving you some quick overview so you kind of understand what we do. Takes about 20 hours to complete. Much of that is face time with the offender, ensuring that they understand what they're doing, but it's also in phone calls to our community partners. We have release planning services at Stillwater, Lino Lakes, Faribault, Shakopee, Moose Lake, Brush City, and Oak Park Heights. If I could have one of the staff. Thanks. I'm handing out one of our templates that we use for release planning services so you can kind of see what we do and what we look through. With respect to employment and housing, two kind of unique challenges for us, particularly for folks coming out of prisons. Thankfully, many of our SPMI offenders have had jobs. And so at the with the help of our release planners, the release planner will call the previous employer to to let them know that the offender will be coming out and to see whether or not there's an employment opportunity for them once they return to the community. I can tell you that, just anecdotally, we don't keep real hard statistics on it, but anecdotally, we do have pretty good success reuniting the offender with a previous employer. Each plan, as you can see, has workforce center information on it. We try and set up an appointment for the offenders so that they know exactly where they're supposed to be going, who they're supposed to be contacting. Our release planners will contact the intake worker for employment resources as well as the workforce center. Some of you may be familiar with our reentry initiative called MCORP. That initiative is actually for all of our population, all of our offender population, but of course the STMI offender can certainly participate in that as well, and so can obtain some employment resources there. Some of our offenders, of course, are not able to work because of their severe mental illness. In those instances, they generally have been eligible for SSI prior to their entrance into prison, and so we will reestablish their eligibility and enrollment in SSI for them. So at least there's some economic assistance there. Housing is a little bit different challenge for us, and certainly housing is a must for the SPMI offender. Prison is, I don't want to say it's necessarily a good place for a person with mental illness, but prison is very structured and it's very regimented. We have what we call supportive living services for some of our lower functioning or our severely mentally ill offenders, and so we tell them when to get up, we tell them when to take their medications, we tell them when to shower, we tell them when to go and get their food. We make sure that they're getting to their jobs if they have jobs. So prison's very regimented and very structured, and that's good for somebody who's got a mental illness. So ensuring that the housing is there is truly a must for somebody who is mentally ill. Actually, our release planners don't have a whole lot of trouble finding housing for somebody coming out of prison. Maybe in some smaller communities they do, but there are some correctional housing options available for us. There are some transitional housing. There's halfway houses. So we really don't have a whole lot of trouble, at least in some of the larger communities. We also connect the offender with a community social worker. So if one of our STMI offenders, for example, has to go to a shelter because one of the housing options that we wanted to place them in doesn't have a bed readily available, that community social worker will then work with the offender through the transition. Certainly we have options and resources available to us to the Native American community. We have female housing available to us as well. And so generally we don't have a lot of problem with that. We don't have a lot of folks coming out. I think we did about 225 release plans in FY06. So it's a little bit smaller population that we're dealing with. We do have a number of SPMI offenders who have co-occurring disorders with chemical dependency, for example. In those instances, we may, we certainly would complete a Rule 25 assessment. We might find an inpatient treatment facility or a residential treatment facility, which would then lead to some sober housing down the road. So if we look at what the needs of our SPMI offender are, there may be a variety of housing options available to us because of other treatment needs. We also have access to a Department of Human Services facility called Agua Ching. The department will be closing that facility and will be replacing it with a forensic nursing home at St. Peter. We don't like to use Agua Ching unless we absolutely have to, and there are some times that we absolutely have to use it. Not using any names, we had an offender who left us out of our facility at Oak Park Heights, our maximum custody facility where we have our residential mental health unit. And due to his mental illness, he eats things. He eats forks, he eats pens, he eats TV antennas, he eats a variety of things. And anyway, because of another option, we placed him in Agua Ching. While he was up there, he ate two TV antennas, and they had to be surgically removed. he came back to us as a result, and he, because he's a release violator as a result of that. He will be going out in expiration, I want to say, sometime this fall, and we have no options for him. Aquaching will not take him back, and so we have no options for him. So in spite of all of the wonderful successes that our release planners have, we do have some very unique challenges as well. This particular offender is one. He's not a sex offender, because sex offenders are actually challenges on a whole nother level. We really will begin having some issues with sex offenders as they are aging. We don't have nursing homes available to us. Certainly St. Peter, the forensic nursing home at St. Peter, will be an option for us down the road. But community-based nursing homes will not take a sex offender, particularly a sex offender with mental illness. So, yes, we have some really good successes, but boy, do we have some challenges when it comes to some of those other, some of our other offenders. So, with that, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Representative Garland. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Larson, do you have any statistics on how many people got jobs with the discharge planning, and how does that correlate with them stop not reoffending? And then, how many people were working inside versus were able to get a job on the outside?
We did a very, very preliminary evaluation of our release planning efforts and the recidivism as a result, and I can certainly get the committee a copy of that. I don't have it with me. With respect to jobs, I don't know. I don't know if our staff inside the prisons track who had a job inside the prison and then did that correlate to a job on the outside, but I'd be certainly happy to check.
Okay.
Ms. Larson. Are there any other Representative Paymar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Larson, has the policy at the Department of Corrections changed at all relative to mentally ill people who are at the end of their sentence but are still in segregation units?
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, I'm not certain I understand your question.
The policy used to be, Madam Chair, Ms. Larson, that someone could actually complete their sentence and be in a segregation unit at some of our institutions who are mentally ill. And when I was up there, when I went up to some of our prisons and realized that, I thought that this seems like not a very good policy, leaving someone in a who's mentally ill in a prison cell 23 out of 24 hours a day, and then opening the door and say, there you go. So I'm just wondering if anything's changed in the last few years.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, to my knowledge, no, it has not changed. I will certainly look into that, and I couldn't agree with you more on that. We do, at our facility at Oak Park Heights, we do have mental health staff who round on a daily basis in our segregation unit very specifically for that reason. But I'll double check.
Representative Paymar?
Well, Madam Chair, I just hope that your committee and as well as maybe our committee could look at that. I just think that we're just exacerbating the problems of these individuals, and if we think that somehow this release plan is going to assist those individuals who get released out of those seg units, we're badly mistaken. And I just think that's an internal policy that the Department of Corrections needs to address. And I'm not sure how you do it, but
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, and Representative Paymar, I'll try my darndest.
Ms. Larson, what would also be helpful, because Representative Paymar is making an excellent point, is not just finding out if that policy is still in place, but who's making the discussions around how we're going to address that, and any ideas and proposals that can be brought back to us would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Larson. I believe I know the answer to this question, but I have to ask it anyways. Why aren't there any release planning services at the St. Cloud Prison?
Madam Chair and Representative Hosh, we very rarely release anyone from St. Cloud.
Madam Chair and Ms. Larson, that's what I thought, because it is an intake prison, but I just want to make sure that.
Thank you. Ms. Larson, now let me ask this question, though. There are a small percentage of individuals who end up in a short stay that end up in one of the MCOR work programs or training programs. So what happens to them?
Madam Chair, I think what you're asking is, like, with work release and IFWIC or sentencing to service?
Some of those folks, Ms. Larson, but also the individuals like the bricklayers, the individuals that may get in that program and stay in that program even though they should have went ahead and went down to Faribault for their release out, but because they were so close in finishing that program, they stayed there until the end of their release.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the staff that I'm referring to do not provide release planning services to those programs. We really do work with our offender population that is behind the wall.
Okay. Representative Rood. Thank you. Are there any other questions or concerns, comments? Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Dahl. Ms. Fink, and I'm not sure who you have with you for the outreach worker. If all three of you guys could come on up at the same time, that'd be helpful. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Sure, and I have some materials for to hand out.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. The Coalition is a statewide organization of advocates, service providers, and people who have experienced homelessness that are working to end homelessness in this state. And you heard it right, we are working to end homelessness in this state, and it includes everybody from the person who is living on the streets with a severe and persistent mental illness up to the person who has become homeless simply because of an economic crisis or is fleeing abuse. We need to make sure that we have a comprehensive approach to addressing homelessness, and if we do so, we can get rid of it. I'm just going to make a couple of remarks before I turn it over to some experts in the field, just to set a context for mental health and homelessness issues. I'll let them go after me and then open it up for questions afterwards. Since I popped in a little late, I don't know if you've heard some of these figures already, but tonight there are going to be 7,000 people who are lucky enough to get into some sort of sheltering program. About two-thirds of those individuals will find their way to a transitional housing program. The other third will find their home in a shelter, and a shelter could be everything from a mat on the floor to something that feels a little bit more like an apartment unit for families. But there's a wide range of services available across the state to address homelessness. You all want to talk about mental health and homelessness, and unfortunately the two issues are so connected that we need the help of this committee and many others to put a spotlight on the issue. There are going to be 1,000 people that are turned away from shelter tonight because we lack space. There are also going to be a couple thousand people that are living on the streets, many of them with very severe mental health problems, that are unable to get into sheltering programs or because of personal difficulties and lack of relationships and being suspect of the system, will not try to even get into a shelter until we form adequate support and outreach to assist them. Regarding mental health issues, I noted that mental health and homelessness are connected a lot. 47% of the adults who are homeless, and that's both on the streets, sheltered, and going in transitional housing programs, have been told by a health professional that they have a serious and persistent mental illness. There's a debate inside the homeless community, a chicken and the egg argument. Some people fall into homelessness with a mental health problem. Some people develop a mental illness as a result of their homelessness. And so we need to be aware that those issues are at play. Also, we need to be aware that the issues of chemical dependency and mental health problems are run in tandem, where there are people who resort to alcohol as a way to self-medicate when they cannot be put on adequate mental health medications or brought through what is often a very difficult process of finding the right medication. Before I turn it over to, as I said, some of the experts in the field, I just want to dispel one myth. We ask, when we ask the public why homelessness exists, the usual answers of affordable housing and living wage jobs always come up, but also an issue that always comes up is, well, people are homeless because they are mentally ill. People are homeless because of a chemical addiction or that they're fleeing abuse. Those aren't excuses for homelessness. If you don't have family supports and a job, a mental illness should not be a reason that you fall so far that you fall to the streets. Something has not worked within our mental health system when we fail to capture people before they fall that far. And the fact of the matter is, we have not had as many people who are mentally ill and homeless as we do today. We did a better job of serving this population in the past, and we can do so again. I'd like to turn it over to Patrick Wood, who for the past 25 years has been an outreach worker to folks living on the streets, who can shed some light on how we can help more people who are outside find their way into a home today.
Mr. Wood. There's a mic over there, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Garden Wood. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. But as Michael said, up until 10 days ago, I was a street outreach worker. I've spent the last 12 years running street outreach programs for the hardest to serve in Hennepin and Ramsey County. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the qualities that make up best practices in street outreach. One of them is meeting people where they are. Just as there are lots of different kinds of homelessness, there are lots of different ways to do outreach. One way is to set up services in the community, make them accessible, and people will find them and approach them. I've been working primarily with people who are the hardest to serve, people who are disenfranchised, people who are suspicious of the system, people who have failed in the system or whom the system has failed, who've been on the street for a long time. They're very distrusting of authority, they're very distrusting of any kind of intervention because their experience with the system in the past has been negative. To use a tired phrase, we go out and we meet them where they are. And I have photographs of where they are. We think that one of the best practices is to be on the street looking for folks, because what you want to do is you want to engage them. I want to talk about three basic fundamentals of best practices in outreach. The first is relationship building, trust building. The second is collaboration, and the third is advocacy. Again, these are folks who are incredibly disenfranchised, who have been failed by the system, and we need to rebuild a relationship with them that gives them the sense that somebody cares, somebody is concerned, and that something can be done to improve the quality of their lives. And this is an issue that takes a long time to. This is a process that takes a long time to develop. We don't go out, find somebody, take them by the collar, and say, "We're going to get you into housing." We have to reestablish a level of trust with these individuals so that they're willing to believe that they can, in fact, succeed. There is a place for them in the mainstream. The second issue is collaboration. We want people to be the architects of their own success. These are folks who don't like authority figures and So our best practice is to work with them to say, what is it you want? What do you need? Now, that's not to say that we don't have an idea of where we would like them to wind up, that we don't do good assessment, but in that trust-building process is a sense that they're in control of their own lives, that people aren't... For years, I was known as the social worker who could not do anything to anyone, and I take a certain amount of pride in that. That ability to collaborate and have people feel as though they are participating in their own success means that they're going to hang on to that success. It's not something that they feel is given to them. It's something that they've earned and that they'll hang on to it because it's theirs. Finally, advocacy. We have folks who are not the best advocates for themselves because of impairments, mental health, and chemical dependency issues, and issues with criminal justice. To help this population move back inside requires strong advocacy skills and connections with agencies and providers who are going to be able to work with them because they know that we're present and we're going to be working with them as well. One of the most exciting things that's happening currently is the Police Provider Homeless Outreach Project, which is in its second year. It's an opportunity for law enforcement to use social services to engage the population that is frequently in contact with law enforcement and uses up a lot of law enforcement time and a lot of resources that could be directed to serious criminal activity rather than sort of status crimes that occur because you're living your life outside. And I'm hoping that your committee and the legislature will take a good look at that because it's an excellent tool. It's one of the best new tools that we have to work with. And at that point, I'm going to stop and pass it on to the next person.
Thank you, Mr. Wooden. I appreciate you bringing these powerful photos for us to look at, too. Ms. Fien.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Fink. I'm with RISE Incorporated. I ran into my president here this morning, John Barrett, who was here talking about the vocational services program. I live and work in Anoka County. I live in Coon Rapids. I have been at RISE for 25 years. I was hired 25 years ago to help people who were in what was considered traditional sheltered work get jobs out in the community. That means I'm a believer. And I have the privilege of doing it in an agency that is driven around self-dependence and increased independence. Many years ago, the McKnight Foundation funded a major initiative that I think transformed in some ways the mental health system. And one of the pieces that the McKnight Foundation funded was something called independent living skills. They also funded some advocacy and some legal services and really drew attention, which was... came to fruition in the 1987 Mental Health Act, and I was privileged to be a member of the Governor's Commission that wrote that first mental health law. And even though it's required some work and attention since then, I have to tell you that it was a very, very good start for the times. When the McKnight Foundation funded, one of the pieces that they funded was called Community Support Services, and it was really before the law started to require those services available in most communities. And so we went about the business of doing something called independent living skills, and it was all a very lofty idea, which was great as long as you happen to have a place to live. Long story short, when we found that people didn't have a place to live, we started the transitional housing program, and we married in Anoka County what was in those days called Rule 14 or Community Support Program, independent living skill services, with some funding out of what is the Office of Economic Opportunity. And that office has been in most state agencies, I believe, in the state of Minnesota, but is now in the Department of Human Services. We married those two sets of services because at that point, the Department of Human Services was not in mental health taking much initiative, quite frankly, in the area of housing. It wasn't quite yet on the radar screen. We were so lucky to have had the opportunity to do that, and with partnership with our Community Action Program, who did some housing, we started leasing some little houses on that were taken on a county right-of-way through the highway department on in a major intersection in Blaine, Minnesota. We took four houses, and we started providing transitional housing. We did it actually in partnership with our Shelter for Battered Women and their children, Alexander House. They took two houses, we took two houses, and then they said, do you want to take those other two houses? So we started this first transitional housing program. Today we serve both men and women, single, as well as families with children. We have patched together a number of different services, from family homeless prevention to mental health money to OEO money to federal home funds, whatever whatever it would take to make it a seamless, when somebody came in the door and they had a mental health disability, if you walk in our door, our job is to provide a seamless response, be it in a housing crisis, be it homelessness, or be it in need of some transitional living. The units that we have are now all over Anoka County. At the high end, the cost of our services are $20 a day. That's furnished, that's with a phone, that's with a brand new vacuum, because I want to be sure there's a brand new vacuum in every unit, on clearance at some store. 24-hour on-call, somebody in my department, we rotate a pager. We're all qualified as mental health practitioners. And it's an opportunity for people to land and kind of make some decisions about where they would choose to live. This is a wonderful opportunity for people who are truly in a transition. And one of the most important points that I want to make is that transitional housing and transitional living services are not necessarily for everybody all the time, but they are a really good match for people who are authentically in a transition and aren't sure where their job is going to be and what community to live in and which bus line do they need to be on, and do they want to live alone, or do they need to live with a roommate? There's a lot of different decisions that we all make when we're in transition. And transitional housing is a really good match for people who are in transition. Transitional housing is not a good match when someone's discharge plan from a hospital or some other setting suggests that they really could benefit from supervision. That, or in a clinical, in a rehabilitation setting, we're a supported but not supervised. We're out a couple times a week. We're on call. We can be there any place in the county in about 15 minutes. But one of my concerns and one of my interests around transitional housing is the fact that the system and all of the board and lodge and the IRTSs and the thises and the thats, when social workers are pressured to resolve a housing problem for somebody who comes in their door, they have to do, which is probably not their first choice, I would suggest, but they have to help people get in whenever, wherever they can. And it's almost a buckshot approach. Adult foster care, transitional housing, board and lodge, wherever you can get someone in. I want to make the point that by using that kind of an approach, we don't always see the outcomes that we could see because we're not matching people for where they need to be. We're matching people for where there's an opening. And someday, when I'm king, I am going to be sure that we have some way of ensuring that we aren't clogging up the system with this buckshot approach, but being very pointed and directed about how we're using the limited resources that we have. The services that one of the goals that we have in our program is that people will make a commitment in as a part of their own choice and their own recovery to be involved doing something meaningful, something that's meaningful to them, 20 hours a week. Our first choice, because I work where I work and the environment that I'm in, is obviously a job, because that gets at the sustained poverty that the people that we serve have in their lives, and as a result have very few choices about where they can live, which is why transitional housing becomes a viable option. If a job isn't on the radar screen in the immediate moment, then we might suggest some kind of a training program, something that will help people move ahead in the direction that they choose. If that's not workable, we do ask people to be actively involved in their own mental health treatment and recovery so as to help point in that direction at some point. And you know what? Very, very few people in our program, when we say at the very beginning, we know that this is the beginning of a transition, we don't get very much opposition to the fact that we believe in people's recovery and moving along. one of the first things that we do is help people try to apply for any kind of subsidy that will be available to them, because transitional housing statutorily is available for no more than 24 months traditionally, except for, you know, an exception, I think, for about 10% of the people that are living in transitional housing. Since December of 2001, people haven't been able to apply for Section 8 in the metro area. It is a non-resource. So the next thing we have to do is find buildings that are taking applications for Section 8, and immediately, I mean, my mantra is, as soon as you get that box unpacked, we have to be sure that you have applied on every single waiting list that's available in the community that you choose. And we are not going to wait after you've been here a year to start thinking about that transition, because that's what the transition is about. I know I'm going along because I kind of, I'll try not to do that. All right. So the last thing that I would say is that the increase in the resources that we have in transitional housing and finding a way to marry those and honoring the fact that transitional housing, there's permanent supportive housing, there's board and lodge, there's other pieces, but to let transitional housing do that which it is good at. Let us be good at what we are good at. Don't ask us to be a residential treatment program. We are not. Do not ask us to be a supervised living environment. We are not. But we are a wonderful option with qualified staff who believe in choice and self-dependence with people, not a choice of an address that Becky Fink decided she could stand and battle the local city council about to get cited, but a real choice in a real place in a real community on a real bus line or with a real garage on the floor of the building that that individual chooses, not the place that I happen to choose for them in the long run.
Thank you, Ms. Fink. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fink, do you ever coordinate with the people that do employment? I'm thinking when they unpack their box, they have 2 years in transitional housing. If they would get a job, they wouldn't need to have Section 8.
Ms. Fink. Representative Garling and members, I would say that would often be true, but I wouldn't say it would necessarily always be true. My real life situation is my office is between the two managers of all the vocational mental health services at RISE. So, absolutely. And, you know, the last thing I want to say about this is, you know, we don't really have a model. I kind of struggle with this whole idea of models, because I think the more that we try to use models, the less opportunity we have for honoring every single person coming in the door with their own life experience. So this close to that is that at the moment that when people come in and we know that their poverty is a big piece of the issue, we immediately look at what it's going to take to address that. And if you work where I work, a lot of that is about jobs. And I'm so excited that in the homelessness provision, the services, particularly in the governor's initiative, there's a real authentic effort right now to be looking at employment as a viable piece of the whole response to homelessness. And I imagine that you're going to have an opportunity to hear more about that during the session, but absolutely. Unpack a box, go to apply, and then we start looking at supported work or some other option. And it works. And it absolutely works.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative
Bratton. Ms. Fink, what percentage of the people in transitional housing end up getting a job versus going to Section 8 without a job?
Well, not everybody gets to go to Section 8. Is part of it. About 60% of the people in our program are working at any given time.
Thank you, Ms. Fink. Any other questions? Representative Ruth.
Madam Chair, thank you. Timely testimony today in light of the fact that it's going to be a very cold night in the cities in Minnesota. My question, I think, is for Ms. Fink, and that is, I'm wondering the process of this. You mentioned the buckshot approach. Is there a web site or a clearinghouse or something, so when somebody does come to you, you're able to kind of see what is out there and what is available, where the vacancies are, and would that be something that would be helpful? Or
Representative, are you saying in a particular community or statewide?
Well, both, I guess. I mean, perhaps it would be county-based, but then, you know, I know I work as a nurse practitioner, and I've had an increasing number of patients who are coming up from because of Katrina. And I will have to refer them to our social worker, who is overwhelmed. And I've often wondered, what happens then? I mean, do people just get a list and they're told good luck, or do social workers have a way to access and see where there really are vacancies and housing? I guess you could start where you're working in the county level, but...
representative members, I in my other part of my life, I chair the Anoka County Affordable Housing Coalition, and every month and most days in between, that's part of what we do is we are on it every day. Who's got money? Who's got openings? And we know each other. Now, that's how it works in Anoka County, but that's because we have this coalition.
Okay.
I can't speak to how other communities respond. I know that when people come through our front door, if anybody today comes through our front door and they don't have a place to be, I'm not saying a place to move into, but a place, a warm place, no one leaves our office without a place to be that night. And then in the morning, we're right back at it.
Mr. Dodd, you have something to add to that?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, not every program can be such that everybody leaves with a place to stay. We do turn 1,000 people away from services each night in this state. And what's frustrating to me is that a number of if you hit the right service provider at the right time where they know that there is an opening, they will help you get to that opening. But what is often known is that we will tell someone, why don't you try this phone number and see if they're available? And then the person calls that place and they say, well, why don't you try this number? And I will have people crying that they have just called 8 shelters with nothing open and a ton of other numbers they can waste a quarter on that will lead to nowhere. And that leads to a lot of people not trying the next day to call folks within the system. We do a really good job in Minnesota of collaborating, but it's a matter of if there's resources to send people to, that everywhere across the state there simply are not enough resources. And so that leads to a distrust of the service providers when the distrust should be of whether or not there's resources those providers have available to work with.
Representative Ruth?
Thank you.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hank, you mentioned people coming to find transition housing, and I think you mentioned families. For that person who's looking for a job right away and out there, but they have a family of one or two children, are there daycare providers or people, you know, that help out with so that that individual can go out and find a job or go on interview and things like that? And are there opportunities that you have for them in that regard?
Representative and members, if people are receiving Minnesota Family Investment Program resources, there are sometimes daycare resources available there. We've raised money to try to pay for a couple of days of, you know, child care here and there. But to get started, that is a real barrier for folks. If somebody comes in, for instance, and they have an interview that afternoon, we've been known to do child care right outside my office door and sometimes in my office door while people are going about their business. But that's not a good answer in the long run, because what if you get hired? Then what are you going to do? So you really do need to have that child care situation in place. And the fact of the child care resources being not as available as we need is a problem for us. All the families that we serve have a parent. One of the parents lives with a serious mental illness. So we can sometimes access some resource in the mental health system. All of our services are mental health related.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fink, what are the percentage of people that come to your agency looking for help that are in this situation, that are families? That are they 50% of the people that come, or is it mostly single individuals that darken your door?
Last year, representative and members, that we had 550 people contact us at the front door, and roughly and 600 of those were adults, and some of those adults had children. Actually, I don't know if this is going to answer your question. It's the best I can do right here, right now. But we had about 550 initial contacts to our one agency in Anoka County. About 600 of those were households that had adults, and there were 450 children in those households. So I'm sorry I can't associate those numbers a little bit better in terms of the number of single adults or two-parent or two-adult households.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Would you like her to follow up with any information for you?
Well, Madam Chair, just if there is a way to make some kind of a delineation or clear between how many you serve as far as families versus single adults, if it's a 50% or 60% or something like that.
I'm sorry, I apologize. I do have an answer for that.
Thank
my
you.
Lucky day. The numbers of families out of that we actually opened services for and were roughly 20, and that means the whole gamut of services, the housing and all of that, not the information and referral or any of that. That's roughly that number.
Mr. Dahl?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, Ms. Fink's talking about a specific program. Statewide, we know from a Wilder Research Center survey that 69% of the homeless women that we come into that we've surveyed have children under age 18. And so, and women account for half of the adult population who are homeless. So most of them are coming with children.
Yes, sir.
Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the testifiers, Mr. Dahl, Mr. Wood, Ms. Fink. I can tell you have a real passion for this issue and for problem solving and that you've been involved for a number of years, so I really appreciate that. I have a very specific question, and perhaps it's to Mr. Wood with your experience in the street outreach. I'm looking at this handout that we have, and it says that in Greater Minnesota, 36% of the men were veterans, and I'm on the Veterans Committee. I know there's a few others in this committee. We're wondering about a recent outreach. At the state level, we've put more funding into outreach to veterans who are homeless, and we're wondering what you're seeing maybe on the street level, if there's good coordination for getting them knowledgeable about the benefits that they're eligible for as veterans.
Again, it depends on whether or not they are aware of those services, whether or not they can access those services, or if their experience has just made them so alienated from authority figures that they think maybe they've been pointing the gun the wrong way. And that's a phrase I hear from Vietnam-era veterans. I can't really answer that question. I know that we're beginning to see veterans from Iraq in our shelter system in the metropolitan area. It is true that of the men who are living outside, approximately 30% of them are veterans from Korea through Vietnam through Iraq. The overall number, the 16% number that gets kicked around is both genders. But again, the services are greatly appreciated. It's getting people connected with those services, and that's one of the roles that outreach workers play, mm-hmm. is to say, look, you know, this service is there for you, and I'll go with you, and we'll make sure you get it.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Dodd, you want to have the last comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Tinkelstedt, I just want to point out that I know that you all here are you want to make sure you're spending your money wisely, that it's results-driven, and we share that goal. But to point out that we do need increased resources for outreach. Outreach is not something where a success can be always be. We got someone into housing. It might be after 2 months of trying, this person accepted a pair of socks from me. And that relationship building takes time that has to be seen as success in and of itself. Worth the investment, and so I ask that you please take a look at how to define success in a way that works for the state that also meets the needs of the individuals who are very suspicious of authority.
We're going to move after we hear from Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Tinglestead's question regarding veterans homeless, you mentioned here 36% of the men were veterans. What are there any women that are in that category of veterans and being homeless also?
Yes, there are. The overall figure of people who are homeless who are living outside is 16%, and that 16% reflects both men and women. And I'm not good enough to do the math to determine. But the overwhelming number of veterans who are outside are men.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're going to get you some information on the Wilder Research Study We appreciate you testifying for us today. Mr. Dahl, before you go, can you get us some information, whatever is out there as it relates to in the metro area, we have more services, transit, and employment, and so we actually get a lot of individuals that end up commuting or transitioning from rural areas that are down here that aren't necessarily from the area. If we have any information that's out there that talks about how many of our urban homeless individuals were rural folks, that'd be helpful too.
Yes, Madam Chair, that actually will be part of the information you received from Wilder, but I can highlight it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Van Hook. Welcome to our committee, and if you could identify yourselves for the tape.
Madam Chairman, on the committee, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Robin Lee Van Hook. I'm a recipient of Bridges, and I'm going to go second. I'm going to let my social worker go first.
Okay. Hello, my name is Emily Tricker with Mental Health Resources.
Can you hold on 1 second, Emily? We need to turn her mic up a little. Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
I'm with Mental Health Resources, and I was asked to come here and talk a little bit about the Bridges program. When housing is unstable, there are constant signs of stress in a person's life, and that stress can highly impact the person, especially when suffering from a mental illness, as it often increases their symptoms. When housing is stable, people can maintain and improve their mental health, and they're also able to focus on other things, such as school, employment, or other interests. Bridges is one of the last programs available to persons with mental illness who are rent burdened. Rent burdened is defined as having to pay 50% or more of your monthly income towards rent. There are other programs for those who have mental illness, but those programs require that people be homeless. Without the Bridges programs, people who are rent burdened would fall through the cracks. So let's paint a picture of what being rent burdened looks like. Imagine that your monthly income is $600. Your rent is $500 and you're also responsible for paying electricity. That means that you have approximately $75 left over after rent and utilities. With that, you have to decide whether you will buy groceries, medications, or other necessities. And if you're lucky, you'll have money to get around and do those things. Bridges allows people to be able to afford all of these things that many of us take for granted. And right now, there are many people who could benefit from Bridges, but there are not enough openings in the program. It's my hope that in the future, Bridges will receive more funding so that it can assist many more people that are very much in need of help.
Thank you.
My name again is Robin Lee Van Hook, and I'm going to speak about being a recipient of Bridges. I want to start by giving you a little introduction to my childhood. My mother was manic depressive. I lived with my grandparents quite a bit, and they brought me a lot of stability. I had, on the whole, a fairly good childhood. But when I lived alone with my mother, she would get ideas in her head about moving. And I can remember having knots in my stomach in the morning, waking up, not sure where we were going to live tomorrow. Not a lot of drama actually got carried out, but I went through that trauma. So as I went into clinical depression at about 30 years old, a college student, a married woman with a teenage son, I was very uncomfortable about leaving the house I lived with my husband in. I wanted to leave the marriage. I wanted to leave marriage for a long time. I did not know how I was going to support myself. And I ended up, because I had done volunteer work in the low-income community, making arrangements with a schizophrenic man who lived in a filthy three-bedroom apartment to rent one of his rooms so that I would have a place to stay when all I had was $5 in my pocket. And the money from county assistance was not yet available to me. I had to wait those few days to get my check. And he was on a check like that, so he understood. But I was embarrassed to tell people who might be middle class. So
thought I was in clinical depression and that I had to go on county assistance. It was really hard for me. And I lived with this man for 3 months. I never used the kitchen once. I stored my food in my bedroom and in my car. I happened to be a vegetarian, which cuts down on the need to cook, but I lived on things like nuts and crackers and things like that. I went to school during that time, part-time, and I worked a job part-time. After a period of time, I decided to just go to school and to try to get custody of my son. I moved into the cheapest place I could find. A little old lady lived downstairs. Her son was running the duplex for her. The place was falling down, but it was a safe, adequate space to live in. Just a few blocks from where my ex-husband and my son had been living. Then I moved from that into the house that my ex-husband and I had. It was torn apart. He'd been starting remodeling. I had to live in a place where I couldn't even have a roommate. I finally couldn't afford it. I moved to another very low rent place. I got in there. It looked fine. The temperature was about 50 degrees. I showed up to move in. The heat had been turned up, and the whole place stunk of animal urine. There had been 6 animals left alone there for like days and days and days and days from the last people we left the place. Well, I was lucky. I found something that cleaned the whole thing up. I couldn't afford to move. I stayed there. I stayed there about a year and a half or 2 years. Then I decided to go to school here in the Twin Cities. That was all in Duluth. Then I came to the Twin Cities. I lived with an elderly man, and I got almost rent-free the second floor of his house to cook him some meals. Well, he turned out to be an alcoholic. I have no background in that. I was horrified. I moved out. I'm in the middle of going to school. I can barely make ends meet. I'm not on medication. I'm not seeing a doctor. And eventually, I ended up in public housing, Minneapolis public housing, after a summer of being homeless and transporting myself between Winona, where my mother lived, and Duluth, where a friend lived, and I would go back and forth. This kind of disruption was just really stressful, and it was very hard on my mother, who was manic depressive, and she did not want me in her apartment. But I was her daughter, and she just, what could she do, you know? And I think a lot of families with mental health problems have these kind of juggling issues, you know? I left Minneapolis public housing when I graduated, and I moved to Duluth, and I was not stable enough to get a job. And so I moved into the least expensive situations I could find. I did okay. Duluth is a pretty safe community. But I moved back down to the cities, stayed with a friend, and ended up on Third Avenue in a building that was a crack building. And eventually, it became evident to me, and I got told the police were looking into things, but I saw things that made me think there was some undercover stuff going on. There was some pretty blatant police involvement in that building, and I should have been pulled out of there, and I had no money, no friends, no resources, no way to get myself out, and needed medication. When I finally was removed from the property in a vehicle I had purchased that was full of my things, I was placed at HCMC. And for the first time in my life, I got a medical diagnosis of manic depression. I had said I thought I was manic depressive. I even pressured doctors into giving me lithium at times. But I finally got a diagnosis that they would not back down from. You know, I thought, maybe I'm making this up. Maybe I'm imagining, you know. And by then, I was about 38, 39 years old. They put me at HCMC. I was there 6 weeks. There was a little medication adjustment, but basically they were just waiting for the medication to take full effect. And they put me in a group home after that. I was furious. I'd worked in a group home for the mentally retarded many years before. I didn't think I was group home material, but I can state it was very helpful. Having people around where I didn't have to hide the fact that I'd been through clinical depression and that I had these other problems was really helpful. Being with this group of women gave me a chance to make some friends. They had a sewing machine. I took up sewing. I had a granddaughter on the way, and I sewed clothes for her.
that little bit of community was really helpful to me. I had a chance to be in another group home that was very independent. Nobody got close, and I turned it down because I missed having a marriage and a home. And I think this is a real issue with isolation for mental health situations. When I got done at the group home, I was very independent. I had my own housing. I had roommates. I had a part-time job. The medication really helped a lot, and everything was going just fine. And then the landlord decided he would not allow anybody to live in the house anymore that was there at the time because some hadn't paid rent. So I had to move again. I couldn't stay at my job. I ended up in the cities. That was Cottage Grove. I ended up back in the cities. I had a hard time finding a place. I got a cheap place with roommates, and my MSA was cut off. It was just one thing after another. That's when I went back to the group home people, got in touch with their housing counselor. They got me on Bridges. I got a small apartment. It wasn't any luxury, but at least it was safe. And it was dependable that I had a place to live. I got out of that situation a year later and moved into a larger community and had been on the board for 3 years of a cooperative that owns the housing I live in. Emily's my third or fourth social worker. When I have trouble with some letter from social services, some letter from my landlord, anybody that's doing business with me, especially numbers, I'll get real panicky. She'll come over and read it and help me straighten out whatever's wrong. I've gotten more education. I work part-time for a nonprofit, and I'm very happy. But I couldn't have done it without Bridges. I tried it. I had a degree from the university. I had 6 years of college. I could not book a job without the medication and the social service support and the housing.
Thank you, Ms. Van Hook.
You're welcome.
Questions? I want to thank you guys for testifying. We're going to move to our last couple testifiers. We only have about 10 minutes. And while they're coming, if you guys can come up at the same time, Mr. Burkett also, just to give an announcement to the committee. First, let me thank you guys for hanging in there for the extra half an hour. We will be doing this for the next several Fridays. We're going to take up Representative Greiling's bill starting next Friday and the following Friday. I think that's the only other announcement. Ms. Ho, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for making time for us today. My name is Jennifer Hope, and I'm the Executive Director of Heart Connection. I'm here today with Russell Sewell. And our goal is to help people with mental illness and long histories of homelessness find a path to recovery through the doorway of supportive housing. In 2000, the legislature created the Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot. The pilot supports 90 single adults and 60 families in Blue Earth and Ramsey counties at any given point in time. That's 718 people since it began. In 2005, the legislature created the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund, which has already begun supporting 540 households in 37 counties around the state in partnership with six reservations. An independent evaluation of the pilot tells us about the challenges participants face. 82% of participants have been told they have depression. One-third have been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. One-quarter report a bipolar disorder. 15% report schizophrenia. Participants have high rates of post-traumatic stress, the result of many traumatic experiences, including physical violence, having loved ones die violently, or being sexually assaulted by someone they know. It comes then as no surprise that there are also high rates of illegal drug use and alcohol abuse, a common form of self-medication. We're learning that people with long histories of homelessness and mental illness can become housed and then use the safety and stability of a home to make gains in other areas. 79% of pilot participants move into permanent housing within their first 6 months of enrollment. 88% remain housed 1 year later. Over time, participants experience a reduction in mental health symptoms, the equivalent of one fewer major symptom a day, like having racing thoughts or hearing voices. Supportive housing combines supportive services and housing to break the cycle of homelessness for people with mental illness, chemical dependency, and other disabilities. Supportive housing looks like regular housing.
The only difference is that services help make the housing stick, which in turn allows the services to be more effective. The Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot and the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund allow us and our partners to house people with mental illness and long histories of homelessness and to provide the services they need to live healthier lives. Safe, affordable, supportive housing and mental health are inseparable. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to introduce you to Russell Sewell and ask him to tell you about his experience in the Supportive Housing Pilot.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Russell Sewell. This is what changed my life, keys to my apartment. I owe my life to Hearth Connection Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot that got me off the streets. I was homeless and struggling with mental illness and physical health problems. I'm here to briefly share my story with you and how important this program was and still is in helping me get an apartment and medical care that I need. It wasn't until my last time in a state mental hospital that my bipolar disorder was even diagnosed. It wasn't until I started with this program that I got the right medication for it. I want you to know that I wasn't always homeless. I've had a job for most of my life. I started working at the age of 14. I lied about my age to get a job. Over time, I got emphysema and would cycle through jobs, and my bipolar disorder began to get worse. Beginning at the age of 20, I had three long stays in mental hospitals, losing 4 years of my life. I would self-medicate mostly with alcohol to get through my manic episodes. I was admitted to psychiatric state hospitals in Virginia, then in Alabama, and in California. When I came to Minnesota, I was working then. I hurt my leg. My parents had long since passed away, and my brother couldn't help. I ended up on the streets. Just think about it. Nowhere to turn, homeless, struggling with depression, and manic behavior. The pilot connected me to a supportive housing team at Gill Incorporated, and they asked me if I'd be willing to talk about what had happened, and of course I said yes. I don't ever want to forget where it is that I came from. All the things that most people take for granted, like I've gone through having to wait in line to go to the bathroom, not being able to take a shower or cook my own dinner, and all these things are things that most healthy people with homes take for granted. When I started working with the folks at Gill, I was close to getting sick and needing to be hospitalized again. They helped me find a psychiatrist, and they helped me with good medications. They came to see me twice a week, and at one point they advised me to go back in the hospital and help to take me there. It was a short stay, and I credit Gill for getting me the help I needed before anything more serious might have happened. I make sure that I get to my doctor's appointments for my emphysema and to my psychiatrist. It can be kind of scary, and I want somebody to go with me, and that team is there. It's this type of thing that they do. I want to wrap this up by stating that people with mental illness don't have to be homeless. Just look at me. I've been in my same apartment now for about 4 years, and before this program, I didn't really understand what was happening to me. This program has given me hope, and you'd have a hard time trying to top the type of help that I've gotten. People wonder if they can change the world. Well, I'm proof that you can. One person or one family at a time. Thank you for your time and considering how others can do the same. And I have one other thing. I used to live out of a backpack. All my belongings that I had, everything in the world, was in a backpack. And I've gone from that to these keys to my work.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, just for you to know, while we have known supportive housing is one of the benefits and that will help individuals stay stable for a long time, the pilot has helped prove that. And you will be hearing more about that in the next few weeks and putting permanent funding and taking the pilot philosophy into supportive funding for the homelessness. So
any questions, you would just know to get a hold of Ms. Ho. Mr. Burkett.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think the first thing I want to say is that it's great that you're a group. I used to come to the legislature in the old days, and I used to come to the legislature 18, 20 years ago to get help for people with developmental disabilities, and it was pretty easy. Then I started at the other agency I directed some programs for people with mental illness, and I began going to the legislature. And you guys didn't pay any attention to me. You didn't know anybody who had mental illness. You didn't have any mental illness in your families, and you didn't want to talk about it. And I'm not talking about each of you individually. I'm talking about you collectively. That was my experience. So the fact that you're here today, that you have a whole division for mental illness, I couldn't have believed that would have happened 20 years ago. I couldn't have believed that. So I just want to express my gratitude, because it's like people talk to me now when I talk about my own sister's mental illness, my own brother's suicide, my agency, which serves 4,500 folks with serious and persistent mental illness, people who are in crisis in our crisis residences, people who are close to suicidal and living in our group homes and may need time in our crisis residence, people who are in their own apartments and are served by our home health agency, people who are in our drop-in centers, our resource centers, and working on their vocational skills. You name it, and we do it if they have serious and persistent mental illness. And we've been playing catch-up, because for years the other disabled groups have had all these services. And finally, people are recognizing that folks with serious and persistent mental illness deserve these services too. And thank you. Past 11 years, though, I've been here just advocating for people with mental illness. And I've visited with a number of you. And because of the generosity of the legislature, we now have a permanent resource center for people who are deaf and have mental illness, which I worked on 7-8 years ago. And again, thanks to the legislature, we now have permanent apartment support for people with mental illness and seizure disorders. So we're moving along, aren't we? Mm-hmm. We're moving along, but we still have a long ways to go. When you think what the other disabled groups, the other disease groups get, but at least we have the social recognition now, and you guys are willing to spend the time. I know that you don't have much time in legislative session to focus on specific disability groups, so I really appreciate that. I want to talk briefly. I know time's about up, but I want to talk briefly about our continuum of services to people who are homeless. And there's a sheet that I passed out to you that's looks a little technical, but as I said, we serve 4,500 people with serious and persistent mental illness in the 5-county area. We have staff, more than 400 staff, and about 11 and a half years ago when I came, just before I came to People Incorporated, we began serving people who live outside. And is Patrick Wood still here? Patrick Wood was the guy who 11 and a half years ago, I came to work at People Incorporated, our Northside Community Support Program, and I saw that we had a washing machine and a shower. And it was just a drop-in center. I said, what do we use those for? And they said, well, there's some people who live outside who use that washing machine and use that shower. And at that time, we had about 4 people that were coming in and using that stuff. And we were beginning to investigate, beginning to find out exactly how many people with serious and persistent mental illness lived outside. And we were able to get enough public funding, so we developed some teams that could go out every morning. Again, initially under Patrick's leadership.
And we did that for years. We did that for about 4 years, and canvassing the Twin Cities every morning, giving people socks, mittens, sleeping bags, whatever they needed. And then about 7 years ago, we began to think, well, we're doing this. We've got some public support for this and some private support, but these people are still dying. We help them stay dry. We help them get in the hospital. They go back outside because there's no real supportive housing for them. There's some housing, but not the kind of support they need. So we decided that we would try to raise some money to develop safe havens for people who've been living outside. And two or three of us went to Chicago 7 years ago, where they were bringing people with mental illness directly from outside and putting them inside. And we looked at their safe havens, and we liked what they were doing, but we saw they didn't have 24-hour mental health staff. They didn't have any mental health staff. People were not necessarily on meds, so they were pretty psychotic. They were pretty out of it. And so we decided we wanted to do it differently. And then I approached my friend, Dr. Charles Schultz, who's the head of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, and said, let's try to develop a pilot project in Minnesota, which could be a model of what safe haven should be for people with mental illness that could be replicated throughout the country. So we started trying to raise money, and we actually did a big capital campaign and raised a little over $5 million. A whole bunch of that money was put toward development of these safe havens. That is, bringing the folks whom we've worked with outside for years inside, giving them a transitional support 24/7 with a psychiatrist who would go out to the camps, and he still goes out. And then transitioning them from our transitional housing to permanent housing. We've been doing that for 2 years now. It's going great. We need about 5 or 10 more of these because we're always full, and we're moving folks on. We're happy that we've got the private and the public support. The private support's not going to hold out forever because they always just want to give seed money. We're also happy that this last year we've been able to extend our services by developing the first ACT team, a serve community team in Minnesota, just for people who are homeless and have mental illness. So we in Hennepin County, we now have 24/7 staff who are at the shelters, and a psychiatrist who goes to the shelter with them. That's not easy to find, but a psychiatrist is willing to dress down, take off the tie, take off the sports coat, just hang out at the shelters. And there are a lot of people with mental illness who actually have been living in those shelters for a long time. They don't have any friends. They just live for their next meal, and they stay hidden. And so it's just a question of drawing them out, developing the friendship, little by little, and then getting them on meds. Finally, we have a program to work that we developed this last year to work with people who are getting ready to be discharged from prison. That's really an important service, and we need that throughout the state. Hennepin County has the one that we hope will be a role model for the entire state, and because a lot of those people who are getting ready to leave prison with their diagnosis, manic depression or schizophrenia or whatever, they're not going to stay on their meds. Often they're not on meds. They'll be either reoffending within a month, or they'll be out on the streets with our homeless people, or they'll be in the hospital. And so that's just another phase of this very complicated process of discovering where serious and persistent mentally ill people are being overlooked, and bringing them back into this human family. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Burkett. And members, we are adjourned.